Council Phil coming?
She's joining the meeting right now, I'm just telling you. Time's in a second.
Okay, great.
We'll start in just a minute, but Bernard was trying to get us to start right at six.
Don't worry, yeah.
What's up, man?
Turn the sparkle on.
I want to turn it off, I'm so tired.
Is that the agenda? Where'd you get it?
I brought this one, but they're already.
Kathleen, would you grab me an agenda? Yes, I would.
All right.
Hello, Ashley. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, hello. No problem.
All right, well, I guess we'll go ahead and get started, and others will join us, trickle in. And this is our fifth quarterly meeting, consulting parties for the Beecher Terrace redevelopment project. I'm Cynthia Elmore, I'm the preservation officer here at Louisville Metro. We'll go around the room and introduce ourselves for those who are online and on the phone, and so everyone knows who's here tonight. And so pass it off to Natalie.
Natalie Woods, branch manager at Western Library.
Wanda Mitchell Smith, legislative assistant for Metro Council District 4.
Kathleen O'Neill, choice coordinator with Louisville Metro Housing Authority.
Bernard Pincus, Louisville Metro Housing Authority.
Pam Bishop, Housing Authority.
John Hawkins, Choice Neighborhoods Office, Housing Authority.
Lavelle White, Blue Boy Entertainment.
Chris Gunn, Kentucky Heritage Council.
Rebecca Ingram, JCPS.
Darnell Fergus, at-large citizen.
Right, so as we always do, beginning, and if those that are on the phone, actually, I guess you could go ahead and introduce yourselves, I guess, for the whole crowd. I don't know who's talking to you, but just in the sense of who else is on the line? Emily?
Sure. It's Emily Allison. I'm with DeBerney and Brooks. I'm a development financial consultant for the Housing Authority.
No, Nicole's on the line?
Yep, Nicole from Housing Authority.
Ashley?
My name is Ashley Bell, and I'm an associate project manager at McCormick Barron.
Do we have anybody else on the phone? No, okay. Well, I think we have a couple of our Darcy Thompson and Ann Bader. Hoping that they're
here or get
online.
Yeah, one or the other.
So, but we'll go ahead and get started then. And for those of you that are on the phone, were you able to access the web? Can you see my desktop?
Definitely,
yeah.
I can.
Okay, good. It's working, the technology's actually working and stuff. Let me also start our other recorder. Thanks for your patience. It's also recorded by Mary McGuire.
I'm with the Office of Housing. I am taking over the job that Adam Lyons took as project manager for
Jay Schatz from Corn Island Archaeology. We did the archaeology at the Walnut Tree Park, and we'll be continuing on with what we call blocks 10 and 12.
Okay. Right. So we'll go ahead and dive into it. Of course, All right, so as we always introduce, of course, that this the Beecher Terrace redevelopment project, a bigger project for Vision Russell, for the Russell neighborhood and the Choice Neighborhood Initiative. As part of that, I'm probably not the best person to speak to the whole process, but I think a lot of us know about that, but the overall transformation of the Russell neighborhood is involved with this project. And so we're with the doing the Beecher Terrace redevelopment piece. And this all arose over a process called Section 106, which is required by the federal government. When we have impacts to historic and cultural resources, they have to be considered when federal money is being used in those projects. And as a lot of us around the table have been involved in this for quite some time, we know that the adverse effects were determined for the site involving the demolition of the Beecher Terrace development, the early 20th century, and then also the archaeology, the below ground resources that were are affected by the demolition and the excavation for the new buildings. There's a red line on the map that's called the area of potential effects. So those are buildings that are surrounding the project site, and so we had to consider effects to those buildings as well in the 106 process. And out of that process, it was determined that there was going to be an adverse effect on the site for the historic buildings that were on the site and also the cultural resources, the below ground resources. So out of that process, we had to develop a programmatic agreement and also a letter of resolution for the first stage one, the nutshell version. Of course, there's the Vision Russell website that has all this information on it. Very helpful as well. So, and of course, these are some of the historic resources that were affected. The community center is still exists on the site, but the residential units are being demolished. And just kind of the project timeline, that a lot of you've seen these before. So we're working through the different stages and phases. And so we've talked about a lot of the first three residential developments. We'll talk about the updates on those tonight as well, and then also our mitigation projects that are going on from the letter of resolution. Ashley, I'm going to pass it off to you as far as any update on demolition on the site.
Yeah, so demolition is progressing, and we expect that the second phase of demolition will be totally done by January 2020. So we're just a few months away from having phase two demolition complete.
Right. Phase three, are you applying for wrecking permits?
No, what we're going to do on phase three, we're going to put the as soon as everybody's moved out, which should be towards the end of this month, more or less, then Summer Baron is going to probably put the fencing up around there and the erosion control with MSD. And then we're going to do, record out to do the archaeological exploration. And then after the exploration is done, we'll start. That's when the demolition will start.
Thanks,
Bernard. I'm pointing at the map here while you're talking.
Yeah, Bernard brought his pointer, so it's all good.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you. Does anybody have any other questions about the demolition to date or anything about that right now?
I didn't catch. What's the end date on the phase two demolition?
January.
Oh, January. Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty much done down to here. Phase two, it's been divided into three parts, 2A, and that's all done. 2B is just about done. We're cleaning up debris right now. And then 2C is in progress. The abatement, asbestos abatement, occurring as we speak. They're taking out the windows, doing work on the roofs. And so this is really the last. This is the last part from 21 through 31 where the buildings are still standing.
Anybody else have any questions?
Right.
Well, you may jump back.
Yeah.
All right, just to remind you of the, this is conceptual site plan, and as we've seen, there's been some changes since we started the process, so this is the latest right now, but just to kind of remind you that we've had three different residential phases that we've looked at, and we're going to revisit one of them, the third one, a little bit about a revision to it, but Ashley, can you give us any updates on feature one residential?
Yeah, so I don't know, did the construction progress photo get included in the file?
Yes, yeah, you want me to skip over to that one? I can.
Yeah, sure, that might be a helpful visualization, but so in the front of the picture, you see that's the phase one building, so they have three stories built and the start of the fourth story built, and they expect to have it completely enclosed by winter to start working on the inside. And then along with that, you can sort of see that in the background on the right that they're starting on the building footings for phase two. And then I also just showed as a frame of reference where the phase three site is. And that sort of continues back to the left too.
Right.
And Bernard, do you have anything more specific than that to ask?
No, other than in this picture here, the phase one building is an L-shaped building, and that's one stairway, that's the elevator tower, and that's the other stairway. So the building will be L-shaped and go all the way out to this tower here. And the four floors all the way around. Yeah, I'm pointing again.
I guess since we're looking at this photo, is there anything else on phase two? I think I had the update for it as well. Is there anything that you wanted to add?
This is Liberty Street's going to be, here's Liberty Street right now where it ends at 9th Street, and it's going to continue all the way across eventually to 13th Street. And we worked with the city, and a traffic light is going to go in at 9th and Liberty, because this part of Liberty is going to be one way, and then the part of Liberty on the west side is going to be two ways. And so everybody decided probably best to put a light in there, because this intersection is pretty heavy in the morning, and both rush hours, morning and afternoon. So everybody figured best to put out. So and the Fisk Court, which is going to be right here, will also be opening up into 9th Street, but there won't be a light there because the island will still be there. So you either turn off from 9th into Fisk or turn out heading south on 9th.
And Fisk Court will now be called Fisk Street.
Fisk Street, okay.
Yes.
Does anybody have any questions about the residential phases right now?
Thank you.
Bernard, thank you. Thank you, Ashley. And site plan. All right. So on to our mitigation projects. Natalie, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Let's see. Natalie Woods from the Western Branch.
From the Western Branch. So as you can see, we have a picture. We got our equipment today.
Yay!
We have no idea. They've had it for about a month, and I said, you know what? Can I get my equipment? I really want to go to this meeting and not say that I don't have it yet. Can I actually have it so I can take a picture and say it's really in the archive? So they've been working on getting the software and things like that installed. They scanned something on a scanner today, and it came out so crystal clear. We were all just like in awe of it. So they got me some really, really good stuff, but that's just the beginning of the equipment, because the room is gonna have to be totally redesigned to house everything the way it needed to be. So that's gonna be coming up soon, but not real, real soon, but it'll be coming up soon. So more equipment will be purchased. What you see there is a 24-inch monitor, and a 12 by 16 scanner. We also have things so where we can scan the negatives, like 35 millimeter films and stuff like that. So I'm extremely excited about that because I have negatives and I have no idea what these pictures are of. Mm-hmm. And now I can actually see that. We are still discussing the storage space needed, because now that I have the equipment in there, we can play around with the sizes.
to make sure that what we purchase is going to be able to house it. So we want to get it to the right file size so that it doesn't take up too much space, but it's still clear. We want to make sure that it's just right. So we're waiting to see what to do with that. Some of the things that I'm going to need some feedback from you guys on are the websites. So yeah, I don't know if you can get those to come up or not. It might not let you do it from there, you might have to do it from the email. But what we have done, and Cynthia can get it to come up, is we have two different websites. So we have the older version that wants to bring up Real Player and nobody can use anymore. It's like we're extremely outdated. KFC's all on it and everything else. Oh, wow. And then they have started working on the newer version of the website. So let me see if this one coming up should be the old version. If it'll come up. Hopefully it will.
If you find that.
Right. Security. Yeah, just tell it not that you know that. It doesn't matter. That's the real player that wants to play, and yeah, wants to be with that. It really will not play.
I like the new version better already.
No, right? Exactly. So you see the difficulty already in getting anybody to really look at the older version. But in the newer version, what we want to do is get feedback from you guys about what you would like to see on it. Right now, we're still calling it Separate Flame, which is what the older version was called. But they've been working on it.
For us.
If you can't get the old one to come, don't worry about it. Just bring up the new one, and okay, they'll come up for you.
Okay, we'll see if I can try it out.
But the newer version, they're doing it in WordPress. They've already been updating and adding things. There's no music files that will not play. But we also have it. Wow, there it goes.
Yeah. Now go to Google Chrome.
Click on the picture. Just click on the picture anywhere. And ta-da, now you get this. And it still doesn't tell you anything. So at the top, see every time it brings up this file that wants to come and play, it's crazy. So click where it says African American Archive. And then you get this. So it's still, you're constantly going through different things. But if you click on, you can try the click on Separate Flame over the, there you go. So this kind of gives you the history and the layout. But there's like 15 million pages to click on. It doesn't give you much of anything. But this is what the older version looked like. So Cynthia, whenever you're ready to bring up the other one, you can. What I would like to get feedback from you guys is if you think we should still call it Separate Flame, or leave it, you know, we can leave it that way. If there's things that you think can be added to the website, changing some things to it, but it flows a whole lot better than the other one did. One of the things I'm trying to make sure that we do is everybody is always so focused on Reverend Blue because he was the head librarian. But nobody talks about the children's librarian, which is Rachel Harris. Mm. We're getting ready to change that. Her history is going to be told also. I have somebody on my staff right now who's doing like a genealogical research on her. So we know that she lived to be 100. She outlived her husband and her son. I mean, there's a lot of really rich history there just based on her alone. So we're going to make sure those things are done. So I may get Cynthia to kind of send that out to you guys so that you can let me know some things you like to see about Western. I'm going to make sure that when we really start to digitize and things are made available on the Kentucky Digital Library, that the links are there. So that's something that's definitely going to go there. But we're constantly adding more history to it. This is just a work in progress. They have not put this one up yet. It's live. But the link is not on the website. So, but just to kind of show you the difference between the two, it's pretty massive difference between the two, but I'm just really glad that they finally started working on it. They were probably a little tired of hearing me. But, you know, at least it's something to go back to the PowerPoint. One thing that we're, sorry. Okay.
So we are also going to be redoing the film that we have. It's also called A Separate Flame that was done back in that time. That tells the story of Western and the archives and all that kind of thing. We've had a meeting with Morgan Atkinson. I don't know if you guys know who he is, but he's a local filmmaker. He just did a film about the library called Our Library. I have a meeting actually scheduled to talk to him again on Tuesday. It'll be my third meeting with him to see what he thinks he can do with it. Paul Burns, who is our communications manager at the library, has asked him what he would charge to do that kind of thing, so we don't know what that particular cost is going to be yet. Just got to talk to him. We're going to be meeting about that next week. One of the things that has come out of this as well is we're going to be doing a program on Eastern Cemetery to talk about the history of it and all the different things that went really, really wrong. And then the following Saturday, we're going to take a tour. The hope is to get people who want to volunteer to help clean it up, but also we want to tell the stories of those that are there. We're starting with people from Russell. That's the very first thing. So Mr. Harvey Russell's story will be told because he's buried there. Albert Mazik is buried there, but Mr. Blue is also buried there. As I have been told, he does not have a headstone. And we are doing research now to make sure that he was not one of the ones that was buried 2 and 3 deep.
Is this the Eastern Library or the Western Library?
Western. Okay. But he ran both of them. But he's buried there. But right now, him and his wife, either one, have a headstone. So we're waiting to find out if there were other people buried on top of him or not. So hopefully we'll know that information soon. But we really wanted to make sure that we were focusing on Russell first. That's the first thing. And then eventually we'll branch out and we'll tell other stories. We're going to go to the last slide. And then our last vision is the feature terrace that we had. Went extremely well. We had Dave and Ann there, and Lavelle all spoke. And then we had Kathleen came and spoke, and everything was received really well. We really want to do another program about all of the stuff that you guys have found. People are still talking about that. Are you sure you can do that other program? We really want to see that stuff again. I'll be talking to you soon about coming back out and doing a program just solely on that. So we're making sure that people are really asking a lot about the redevelopment and asking a lot about the things that are being found. So it was very, very popular. But we're not going to do another one until just on Visions of Beecher Terrace until there's more development. I think LaBelle might beat me up if I want to do another one right now. But we'll do another program on the side from that.
That's
what we've got so far.
Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie.
You're welcome. Lavelle. The project is currently still underway. The Beecher Terrace, we held a Visions of Beecher Terrace panel on July 31st, as Natalie said, and we showed a 5-minute clip of some of the progress we're making so far and explaining it was an informational video explaining where the project was going, where direction it was going. And so we showed this and presented it to the crowd that came out to the Visions of Beecher Terrace panel. Some of the other things that's been coming along around since the work around Beecher Terrace has been happening. I received a BME Genius Fellowship Award because some of the work surrounding with the Beecher Terrace documentary. And we also conducted 3 panels so far with the Visions of Beecher Terrace. And then, but you can watch this.
I think I'm gonna have to do the same thing like this. Yeah. Go back out. I it worked earlier today when I intended into the program, but let me go back out here. Thank you.
of Newell and Russell neighborhood, they actually tore down the whole commercial strip. That in itself was very traumatic in terms of impacting growth. The declining of the neighborhood into poverty started at that time.
That neighborhood was targeted by, you know, specifically by urban planners like Harold Bartholomew to be physically divided by Nye Street, and this was all from recommendations at the federal level.
The story of Beecher has changed as public housing has changed its presence and form in not just our city, but in America as well.
This is a fond memory. We would be outside playing all the kids. And if Batman came on TV, the court would clear out. I mean, the game would stop. If it was a baseball game, basketball game, Batman's on. Uh-oh, I'm going in. Batman's on.
The average household income in the Russell neighborhood is approximately $8,800 a year.
Now, when we talk about $8,000 a year, that's extreme poverty. We have that right here in the heart of our downtown.
Now, for those folks that are working, it's about $15,000. In any event, that is nowhere nearly enough money to live on and to have a living wage.
After I got my high school diploma, I decided I was going to work. And I tried it. I ended up getting a check at Kroger's trying to pay my child support. And I ended up one check, you know, after union dues and taxes, I had a check for 61 cents.
There is so many of us that have made it through and became a lot of good people. And it wasn't because of the building, it was because of the inside, the home life. It had nothing to do with the building.
Because even through the many challenges and obstacles that I've had, I've been able to prevail and move forward. I'm the first one in my family to achieve a master's degree.
And I think the community at large would be surprised, pleasantly surprised, to see the number of, you know, upstanding, fine individuals who have come out of public housing over the years and gone on to great success in their lives.
I am going to miss it. That was our old home front. That's where we met a lot of our friends, went to school with them, played with them.
It's always sad to see a neighborhood like with so much history in it to go down like it, because people are like, it's like losing a house, losing like a part of your, you know, childhood growing up. But it's always good to change for the better, you know what I'm saying, the positive.
What I'm hopeful of is that the Housing Authority will be able to take a look at who they're displacing and who wants to return and make sure that they set up mechanisms so that people can return.
I'm never against change. Change is always great. The folks that's been here for a long time, I mean, they need to have choices as to how they're going to continue their lives.
As government encourages industry and business to make investments in low-income and underserved areas, they will generate the growth that we need over time. It has to come with time, and it will.
Public housing, which is all low-income housing, is going to be replaced by mixed-income housing, which will be a portion public and a portion market, and some in between. So I think that's going to, that investment creates a new fabric for the neighborhood.
So the vision and the dream would be, as you're coming through the Russell neighborhood, you'll start feeling the vibrancy of street level retail, entertainment. It's not going to be the way it is today. It's going to be very different. So we're hoping folks will embrace the growth and embrace the newness and embrace the new amenities that are going to come along with that.
Short version of what's being created right now. It's still a work in progress. We was actually out on the site today filming some drone footage of the neighborhood and construction, getting some up-to-date shots and stuff. And so we're getting current footage, up-to-date stuff. All right. So it's a work in progress right now. We're working with the editor to get a final completion date towards the end of the month. And we also did some interviews with Senator Drug Neal recently to be included into the storyline, and with Bud Dorsey as well. And then we're going to go out and get some more drone footage as the progress happens and stuff on the construction site to finalize the piece in the upcoming month. That's going to be a 30-minute piece. Yeah. Any other questions? No. Thanks.
Thank you.
I think Darcy is here as well.
Sorry.
Darcy, come on up. Darcy talks a little story program.
Hey everybody, sorry I got a little late. So this last quarter, the early part of it, we were pretty much maxed out on wrapping up a different book project, but we made some good progress. I mean, it's still the slow build for us. We're going till 2022 on this, so we continued outreach to some new folks, particularly interested in folks who names that maybe none of us have heard before, you know. And we've been kind of progressing with the, I don't know, you can go ahead and advance the slide if you want. This is kind of fun. So one of the, I mean, I'm still up to the photography stuff.
Yeah.
Still the one that is just really incredible and very moving is the photography of Nat Brown, who had such an iconic portrait studio on 22nd and Chestnut. It actually had a different location before that that was also in Russell, but it's usually that's the spot people think of, and that building collapsed in February. I've got some photos here from that. That's him as a 26-year-old young man before he was doing photography and political cartoons for the Louisville Defender and all that stuff, and certainly before his studio. So these are just some, you can just go, there's some shots from different parts of Russell. Yeah, so these are all kind of, here he is with his family when they lived, Madison Street. Here's from Beecher Terrace, just mom and daughter's baking scene. It's really just a beautiful photograph. So here he is with a couple of his daughters and neighbor kid for a brochure that was used for a health brochure. Mm-hmm. This is, as we know, like one of the two buildings that survived from Old Walnut Street is the Church of Merciful Savior. And so it's a Halloween party from the 40s there. It's really kind of cool to see that. None of these are in any archive yet. They need to be. This is West Chestnut Street Baptist Church before it was torn down and the current one was built, a baptism scene from there. It's just a little, I don't really know who's in this photo yet, but this is also kind of a different part of the Russell area. This is one of the dancers from Jewel McNary's Dancing Dolls. This is a big part of a lot of people's stories of their childhood and growing up and what gave them a lot of the tools to be successful in life later on, like so many people really. There's a little quote from Carrie Jones about her experience and about how so many of these elaborate costumes were sewn by these really, really talented women in the neighborhood who probably didn't really get any formal recognition. So there's a lot of beautiful stories wrapped up in that. And so some of the stories of Jewel McNary are kind of some of the narratives that people have been developing in the early stages of what we've been doing. They can keep going. There's just, a birthday party. This is the kind of photo gets taken when your dad's a photographer at your birthday party from the early 50s. This is shot in a restaurant of Central High School basketball team after winning the championship. Beautiful shot there. You can kind of be pretty quickly if you want to. Just some samples. This is while the new West Chestnut Street Baptist Church was being built, they had services actually at Central High School. And this is a shot from a Sunday. There. It's just a beautiful family shot from the upstairs of the portrait studio on 22nd and Chestnut. Yeah, so just some a little sampling of some of the kind of tip of the iceberg of some of the photographs and they all have like full stories behind them. We don't have all those yet. We're spending a lot more time with the family and other folks, and there's other photographers obviously we're still reaching out to. So I just want to share some of those. But we've kind of been scanning some photographs, including photographs that are just out of family albums. They're not professional, just people hanging out in Beecher Terrace in the 70s and 80s, things like that, like Polaroids, and kind of trying to get context around the people and their lives. So we've got some a few hundred pages of pretty raw narrative at this point. We still need a lot of back and forth with the folks to kind of give shape to them and develop them, and there's a lot more people will get involved still to come. And then we've been continuing our research through just existing stuff. We've been focusing on oral histories that are housed at U of L or UK that are relevant and that were conducted, you know, maybe in the 70s or 80s. Getting a lot of good context and good stories from that. We started our class at Central High School, which has been really fun. So third period classes, write a book. And I don't really know to the extent to which that may or may not overlap with this particular project. And maybe we do stuff next year at Central that is more explicitly tied to this. But we have 12 young authors that we've met 8 times so far, and they've been writing a lot of really great stuff. And that's kind of, we're early in that journey and really excited about it. And we're getting ready to start probably next month a writing workshop at Russell Apartments for residents there. We kind of formalized that with New Directions Housing Corporation, and we just need to just finalize the exact dates. But it'll be like a weekly workshop, but we'll do like a 2 to 3 hour writing workshop once a week for 8 weeks, sort of pilot, see how that goes, see if people are enjoying it, see if there's seeds of interesting stuff, and kind of go from there. That's really excited to kind of have some formal writing workshops like that for, that'll mostly be for elderly folks in the community. We anticipate that people with families might not have the time to necessarily devote to a writing workshop. So we got that established. Don't have anything to report from that yet, but we're still just kind of getting going on lots of fronts. And expect in the next quarter, while the weather is nice, it's going to get even nicer, and throughout the fall, focus on a lot of outdoor stuff. So a lot of these outdoor spaces where people gather in community that are really interesting to us. There's one on 24th Street. There's one like just north of, there's one on 19th Street. There's one corner of Elliott Park. There's a really great group of folks we've been spending time with. So doing a lot of that stuff and kind of doing some walk and talks with folks that have a lot of history in the neighborhood. I did one today, actually, out in on 27th Magazine area. And just, I think that's a great way to just get a lot of memories and involve folks. And so we'll be focusing on that in the coming few months here and, really keeping moving on all those other fronts. Any questions?
Thank you. If you're on the phone and you're not on mute, just we're getting a little feedback, so just make sure. Maybe multitasking, that's fine. let's see. Anne and Dave are here. Archaeology.
Okay. You can go to the next slide. Just to tell you a little bit where we are, we've completed the state level documentation for the bleacher wall. Haven't heard any comments back. I don't see Jen, but I guess she'll let us know if there are any. I think we owe them a hard copy. We've completed the field work for Old Walnut Street Park. We have had a constant stream of communication with folks in Canada who have been sending me a lot of information and some family stories about the Fitz Butler family. And also there's another archaeologist in Toronto we've been communicating with who's had a very large ongoing urban project focused on the Sheddle Jews, and so we've been sharing information back and forth with those because there's a lot of relevance to what we've done. We have now finally washed all the artifacts from Old Walnut Street Park. All the phase one and phase two artifacts are not only washed, but they've been cataloged, and that's 28 boxes. From phase three, we have 61 boxes. They are all washed, but they only 9 are cataloged. And if you want to look at this, let's see what this looks like.
Wow.
And that is about a third of what we expect to collect. So there's a lot of stuff yet to do, and so we're just trying to get through that. See if we can go to the next. So in terms of some public education, I don't want to jump the gun on what may come later, but we've given 10 public and professional presentations so far. And on October 7th, we're having an Archaeology Day event at the Fraser that's going to, you know, be archaeology in general, but we'll kind of focus on Beecher Terrace. We've had some meetings with JCPS, and you'll probably hear more about that later. We've been kind of focusing on developing 5 to 10 educational kits for classroom use. And I'll show you a little bit more about that. And we're still trying to come up with, as it's in the MOA, planning this public event. And because that we may not be starting until mid-October on this next phase of work, and which we hope to have done by January, I don't know if it's going to be an ideal time to get anybody out there. So we may have to rethink how that's going to happen. But we're still working on the logistics of that. Let me put the next. So these kits are kind of, they're in little small white boxes, and they've got, what we're trying to do on those is to make sure that we get some artifacts, not only in displays, and we're talking about displays at the Fraser, at the Beecher Terrace Community Center, and at the, what, the 404 building, I believe, is that what you called it?
450
building, okay. Sorry. Anyway, but we want to get some artifacts in the hands of kids, and so these kits are going to be accompanied by a curriculum. And it's not going to be just a thing of here's what an artifact was 100 years ago and here's what it is now, but they're going to be accompanied by a series of questions that kids are going to have to work through. And we've got some potential themes here, you know, like foodways and education and dining practices and, you know, just an all number, just some things that we're talking about. If you want to show the next slide, things like personal hygiene. Well, we've got an entire shaving kit that came out. I believe that might have been from the Maple Street, but then these toothpastes, toothbrushes, etc. We have a number of artifacts related to each one that we hope to build a series of questions around for the kids to be learning about. If you want to go to the next. Again, things maybe around education. I don't know if you can see the inkwells and the slates and the styluses. And over on the very far right, it's hard to see, but that one is actually scored as though it might have been used for music. So we've got a number of artifacts related to those. So, you know, looking at not only the different themes that we could have, but also maybe looking at artifacts that are associated with particular people. Those we would not, I don't think, want to put into a kit, but maybe would be more appropriate for a display. So, for instance, the Fit Butler stuff might want to be something that is not something that we put into the hands of the children. Okay. So then, understand mid-October, perhaps, we'll be getting back out to our last two-thirds of the field work. This is block 10. This is the block where, and you can go to the next slide, where we will probably be encountering, you probably won't be able to read this, some of the houses that were the larger houses, the bigger lots, probably the ones that were better economically positioned. And in that, there will be probably more of the white folks, that Europeans, maybe some native-born people. And those are the lots that we're going to be focusing on. But I'm going to share with you, if you go to the next one, block 12 down on 13th Street, these are lots. Now, we're not digging at each one of these lots. We've got a couple of alternatives built in there just in case we can't get at the lots because of buildings or trees or whatever. There's some alternatives built in there. So I'm not suggesting that we're going to hit every one of those lots. But if you go down to the next slide, and again, this is going to be something that's a little harder to see, and Dave, maybe you can show them better. It might be on the next one. It's William Johnson. He is African-American who had the Kentucky Standard newspaper, owned it, and was the publisher. Is that, I'm remembering that right, I hope?
Yep.
Okay. And then there's another one. Is it on the next slide, where we have a number of doctors, black doctors who lived at this one particular lot. So, you know, we're still teasing out the information on these lots. So, but those are the ones that we're going to be focusing on this fall, and hopefully we'll be able to wrap this field work up before the beginning of the year. And, you know, then we can settle down into, you know, writing all the reports and getting everything established.
Sarah just identified a a new person, the first African American undertaker, licensed undertaker in Kentucky.
Oh, wow.
Just today.
And that on one of these lots?
Yeah, on one of our selected lots. I'm not sure which one.
Okay, all right. So there's a few Jewish families we're targeting. There's some, you know, again, we're just now getting into more detail on some of these families. But it seems like there's a lot of, there's German immigrants I see here. I think I saw some Irish at the other, but that's where we are.
Do you have any questions?
The kits. So you're working with JCPS on how to store those, distribute those. I was just curious as to how y'all were thinking about that.
And you may want to jump in and talk about this a little bit more, but we were trying to work on the logistics of who was going to hold those and how they were going to get in the hands of the teachers. And is there going to be a checkout system and how it's going to be advertised and you know, and how they're going to fit into their curriculum. So, you know, we've been talking about it. We haven't worked all that out yet. And what would be the best way to get it? We talked about having them at libraries, you know, so we just, yeah, that's something that we need to discuss. And certainly that's not the only thing that's involved in the education piece. And I figured you would be talking about that. So,
I didn't see that. But, yeah. But that's the hardest part of the kids is getting it in the hands of people.
Right.
Those things rarely ever succeed.
Well, we've been doing it just at Corn Island, not related to Beecher Terrace, and it has been pretty successful. Like the prehistoric kids, Tully School in particular uses them, and they just come and they pick them up from us, and then they check them back in. They keep them for a week, and they check them back in, and that's been working pretty well. We're just not getting the word out widely enough to people, and you know, it would be better, I think, if we weren't holding them, if they were in a place that teachers frequent more often and could get them, you know, instead of coming out to me to get them.
Yeah, and getting that word out too.
Yes, and yeah, so we talked about
what they're teaching in the classroom.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's just the hardest part about any of the stuff we produce.
Right. It's just that we felt like, you know, you can see displays and you can see videos and you can listen to talks, but we really wanted to get some of these, especially the duplicate, in their hands that they can hold.
Yeah.
And then be looking at specific questions related to those, you know. So not just sitting there, oh, look, this is a neat old thing, but what can we learn from it type of thing.
Yeah. Things were hard in the past.
Yeah.
We'll go beyond that.
Yeah.
I know you have me down on the agenda, but I really think that Pam and Rebecca would be better at presenting these slides. And
I can kind of give an intro, and then if you want to get more into detail, does that sound okay? So we did, and we were able to meet. Everyone survived the start of the school year and rollout of new curriculum and standards. So we were able to meet with Ann and with Rebecca, JCPS, and with Rachel Platt from the Fraser Museum just this Tuesday. And so really what we tried to accomplish during this meeting was to narrow down or refine our focus on what the different components of this education piece, the K-12, what that would look like. And so these are kind of the main components that we left with. So we have the inquiry-based learning curriculum at the elementary, middle, and high school levels. The kits that Ann spoke about that would tie into that, an exhibit at the Fraser History Museum, permanent installations, and possibly other non-permanent installations at the new Beecher Terrace site and other sites in the Russell neighborhood and possibly beyond, and then a summer archaeology camp at the Fraser Museum. So they do these summer camps, and you know, we think if we could do the pilot of one of these, and then it could live on and be sustainable within their regular offerings in the future. So now from this list, then now we're going back to our respective desks and putting some numbers to the scope of work and narrowing down what resources are going to be needed to make this happen so that we can come up with a finalized agreement, intergovernmental agreement with JCPS. So that was the aim of where we left our meeting, and we're looking forward to the next one when everybody comes back with more meat for the plan. Mm-hmm. So, and I will let Rebecca then talk in more detail.
So for JCPS's piece, we're very interested in the just the local connections, mainly because our new standards support Kentucky K through 12, but also a lot of the skills and the thinking that's required around all of the work that you all have just discussed in your respective areas that students need to see and understand, because it's possible careers for them. It's understanding their society and their world and why our city is the way it is today, among many things. So the idea is that we would have a cohort of teachers that we would work with very closely, 6 teachers, 2 from each level, 2 from elementary, middle, high, and that the teachers will get a in-depth lesson in how to deal with the inquiry process, which is the foundation for our new standards, looking at questions, tasks, sources. And the inspiration would come from all of these sources that you have heard from tonight. The artifacts that Natalie is bringing to the table, Lavelle's documentary and Darcy's story is bringing that together. Also building upon those kits that Anne and the Corn Island team are pulling together, that those would all be opportunities for inspiration for teachers to build these focused inquiry questions that would allow their students to explore all of the multiple elements that you guys have unveiled, that you've talked about over the past several meetings. So what you see are potential questions that I just came up off the top of my head listening to your all's conversations, and I even wrote down 3 more tonight that teachers could use as inspiration, or they can find something they know their students are definitely going to gravitate towards, and it can connect within the curriculum that they're currently doing, because we structured it so teachers have about 50 days where they can choose how they want to go in depth with something. And one of those could be this focused inquiry that they're doing. The ultimate goal is that our students would be taking informed action and to understand how they themselves as citizens can be a part of what's happening in their city, what's happening in the history, the preservation of the history of their city, and even making their own history and being involved with their communities and their city. So this is just the tip of the iceberg for where teachers could begin and can move from. And they're by no means refined questions. Like I said, they're just off the top of my head. But our hope is that the teachers would be able to hear from quite a few of you that are here tonight to share your perspectives on how you contribute to this project, and to build from that, for them to use those kits, to use the work that's been produced, to inspire the conversations that we need our students to be having in the classroom.
Yes.
Well, not so much questions, but advice, because some of the things that we dealt with the Davis Bottoms project would be important for you all to know as well. And it's really important to have, it sounds like you're going that direction, but not to just see, and I'll just use archaeology as an example, but obviously you're prepared to draw in a lot of other expertise as well. But not just as resources, those people have to be intertwined with that process. So thinking about it in the way of just taking teachers and going to archaeologists and say, give us stuff and we'll do something with it, it doesn't really work out as well, because you don't know what kind of stuff to ask for. And so it's about asking the right questions. And so that's why it was important that it, at least for the archaeology component of the Bottoms project, was that we had archaeology teachers doing it together. So I knew to go to the archaeology consultant, and I knew exactly what to ask for, because I was an archaeologist. I don't create lessons because I'm not a teacher. But that collaboration made it better. And so I think you have to be prepared for that. And on top of that, and lucky for you all, you have Corn Island as your consulting, because on the project I dealt with, I had a non-cooperative consultant that I had to deal with who was not going to give us anything, even though I asked for it. And I know that Ann would do it for free, but she shouldn't have to. So those things have to be considered as well, that this component of what she does or any other archaeologist you might bring in to help consult, that needs to be part of the process as well, that is funded to have somebody do that. So it is really important to think about it in that way, because you're not exactly going to know exactly what it is archaeology can offer, or a geographer can offer, or a historian, or any of the other folks who are working on the mitigation part, you know, what they bring to it. So having more of those meetings and having more of those discussions, these questions are great, because these are archaeological questions, but you can certainly get into a lot more, as you all know. I would also say, one thing we learned from our project is don't be afraid to address race and socioeconomics, things like that. We were very apprehensive about doing that, but that's something that all the white kids that we tested this with, they were all white, about this African-American neighborhood in Lexington, was how much they related, regardless of race and socioeconomics, to the kids that were discussed in our curriculum. And we found that we were really apprehensive about getting into some of those things, but we found that that's where they wanted to go. And there was a natural affinity there that went in a place we didn't expect. So I'd say don't be afraid of that kind of stuff. Definitely make it a part of your process, your contract or agreement, or whatever it is, to have it set up so that you have that kind of communication with the people you're getting resources from, because it will make it that much better. Also, don't be afraid to ask me questions if you want. I'll be glad to come to a meeting and share my experiences with doing this stuff. There aren't very many of us who have done it before, as archaeologists, who have done this kind of stuff. So I'll be glad to help anywhere I can.
Well, we had talked a little bit too about making kind of like little short, almost YouTube videos of everybody's role and sharing those little clips or something in there, and then having everybody understanding the whole process, and then also having folks come in and give lectures or talks, or actually, you know, we weren't actually thinking about divorcing, you know, the teachers from the professionals. We were hoping to get them all involved. But again, what we found out, like with the Maple Street project, is really needing to have some very tight parameters, like, or even with Riverport, is like, how long do I carry around this traveling display of artifacts to every different library? Is it 2 years or 3 years or for the rest of my life or something like that? You know, you kind of needed to have some kind of very clear, you know, parameters on how long this involvement's going to be or how much it's going to be. I mean, you know, it's just not something that has a life of its own, so it has to be kind of pretty
clear.
That's
why you have teachers and resource people, because they know, they have the teacher culture part of the thing. Where we fail as archaeologists is understanding teacher culture and how they really use stuff. And so we think it's great, we can produce all this stuff, and we think it's awesome, but nobody ever uses it. So you have that component, but yeah, certainly I won't think for a second that people that it's designed to be separate that way, and people are designed to have silos. But what I'm saying is that you have to actively do things to keep that from happening, because it will naturally happen. And it has to be built into the yeah. system to make sure that it does happen.
Excuse me, I have a tickle. JCPS has a racial equity policy, and in that, social studies was specifically named as bearing some of that responsibility. So that's one of the amazing benefits of this particular project, because it opens doors for teachers to access information in their own communities, that they're talking about families that have grown up here. Their own students may very well be connected or say, you know, it's the students will see themselves in the stories that Darcy is collecting and the interviews that Lavelle is having and the artifacts that Natalie is collecting. And those that Corn Island is pulling together. Like, you know, you said, you know, they related to things. So we can't, and like I said, this being the tip of the iceberg, there are some more questions that I'm sure I could create of a more, that someone considers to be a more controversial nature. But I think that speaks to our larger mission within our social studies goals, is that we are going to be having professional learning for all of the teachers in JCPS. An opportunity for them to join in dealing with controversial conversations so that they can better understand how to address those within their classrooms, and to make them feel comfortable so they can make their students feel comfortable in an intellectually safe space, that we can discuss these ideas, these concerns, these things that come up, whether we're in whatever we're dealing with. The other beauty of the standards that we have is that they're no longer siloed the way that they used to be. Our previous standards were a checklist of things that were grouped into, as you said, these silos of disciplines, and now teachers can no longer do that. The history, the geography, the economics, the civics were written intentionally to be this, to work with each other, to sharpen each other. And the inquiry standards that are specifically stated are reflective of all of these thinking skills, these types of thinking that are that you're seeing addressed in this panel. So it's not, I mean, we have sixth grade teachers who are, you know, they're thinking like archaeologists. They're asking questions that archaeologists would ask. We have seventh grade teachers who are asking about geography and thinking about space and the use of space the way geographers would. And so these are the types of things that this particular project can provide teachers, not just connections to the curriculum, but also thinking about how they design lessons in the very way that you just said, thinking about the skills and helping teachers to understand what that looks like from all of these particular disciplines. So I'm very excited about where it can go, about the opportunity for this and the inspiration that teachers are going to see for their students in their classrooms. So we're eager.
So you're going to have so you have some training components?
Yes, we have to. We have to, because these standards became law as well. So yeah, this is very new for teachers, but it's a great opportunity for us to capitalize on those standards and to help teachers get involved with their community.
You might be able to pilot some of the lessons.
During
that as well.
Yeah, they'll have to.
Very helpful. Yeah, and definitely the fact that this stuff can be relatable to people in the community, but just as important for, you know, the kids out in the East End to use this material as well, because it teaches them about other parts of the city that frankly have negative stigmas and stereotypes associated with them, and getting a better understanding is how those things get broken down. And we found that some of the lessons that we did on the data spot was really good about doing that. So there's some great opportunities here. I think it sounds great. Exactly.
And we did actually discuss, you know, when I say looking at what resources are needed, that any consultation that might be needed in addition to what folks are already doing in regards to your individual projects be taken into consideration. And we also discussed leverage contributions that can be, you know, added to the pot to help us in our reporting and illustrating what everyone is bringing to the table.
That's great. It's just going to make it. It's going to make it much better. That much better.
So, just a question of you. When you were doing David Spade,
I do that too all the time, Darnell.
I was making wages. You were talking about different grade levels. I mean, like early elementary to middle school to high school, wouldn't that be a different component of what they see and whether or not there's parent interaction? I mean, you could load up a question or something and then send it home, and then that creates a whole other set of things. I'm just wondering how the school system.
Yeah, I mean, the school's a debt, the school system's a debt to dealing with that. But our particular thing was geared to a much more narrow range of students and grades. This is going to be much wider, so you're going to have a variety of things that you can and can't do.
Right.
And you guys know all about that, so.
Yeah, and that's the reason why we wanted two teachers from each grade level, because these questions, this type of conversation that we're having, that we've been having, is reflected in the curriculum at all three levels in various ways. So the one thing that makes some of these questions, I guess for lack of a better phrase, living, is that they can live at both elementary, middle, and high, and they can be looked at with different sources and different perspectives and different tasks.
So with the standards now, you're not just getting local history in third grade or fourth grade, it's through all the grades now. So that's the beauty of having it set up that way, and it works perfectly for what we're doing here.
Again, I take it.
Yes, the choice team just moved our offices. Right. So as soon as we can find our things
desks
again, we will be setting up another meeting. Probably within a month.
Sure. Yeah.
On your agenda, we had the Beecher 2 residential, but Ashley sort of covered that at the beginning. We moved it forward because we had the Google current construction site photograph. So we'll skip on into Beecher Stage 3, the revised piece of the determination of effect. As you probably recall, you've got several letters from us about this, but last year in November, we had to, because we were working with the development team, did the what they're calling residential grade. So this is what we showed you back in November and at the December consulting parties meeting, where those two sites would be the effect there. For the new construction, and those buildings are the townhomes and a variety of buildings, and also on the 9th Street side, the four-story, but they still have project teams online.
Yes,
that piece, or Kathleen knows.
It's a 23-unit four-story building with an elevator.
And so during that, we met, we did the consulting parties face-to-face meeting at the quarterly meeting. We Metro had determined there was no adverse effect. The correct terminology is to say no additional adverse effect. And SHPO concurred with us at that time. We didn't receive any other consulting party comments. But as the PA states, if there's a change in the design or the site layout, we need to reconsult with you. And so about 2 weeks ago, sent you guys a new letter with a packet of information. Of course, I should say, here's what the design precedents, the inspiration for the building. So now we've expanded the project area for three. It's still in that little square, but then it's come over. So it did stop here. Now it comes all the way over here, and then bumps up right here. And that's the stage two piece right over here, which we've already consulted on. So our determination, again, that there was no adverse effect, but to clarify, to be no additional adverse effect, because there is an adverse effect on the entire site from the original, the work for the demolition and then the excavation, and affects the archaeology. So keep in mind, there's always an adverse effect happening on this site. And it's the reason we had the letter of agreement and all the great mitigation projects going on. But we are consulting with you now on this expanded project piece. It's basically added more buildings, more residential units. Kathleen may be able to add.
Essentially, what we're doing is combining the former phase 3 and phase 4 into one phase, which will be the revised phase 3, which is almost double the size that it previously was. And we're doing that, one, because we are behind on our production schedule. We must complete all the unit constructions by September of 2023, and we had some delays up front, so we're trying to pick up the pace, and we're also looking at some cost efficiencies from combining those two phases as well. So that's the why behind why we're doing the larger phase.
And in the letter that thank you, Kevin.
Pardon?
So thank you for adding that.
Oh, you're welcome.
We'll fill in the side of it. So our determination of no additional adverse effect is that, of course, that there won't be any buildings on these locations. Obviously, they've been demolished, or in the process of being demolished. But it does not impact, of course, the Church of our Merciful Savior is down here. There have been buildings here previously. So that site is still in its state of, it's not impacted adversely. Also, the Baxter Community Center is here in the park. We're not adversely impacted by that change. So we still stand by our determination of effect that there's no additional adverse effects to that. We are still in consultation with, of course, consulting parties and SHPO on that. And we'll be sending a revised letter to you so that we have the right terminology in that, so you'll have that, so probably going out tomorrow, so you see that. But that's my part right now. I don't know if Chris has anything to add from SHPO, okay. or if anybody else has any questions about that part or concerns. And we still have another 15 days for comments from the original letter that went out. So that would be, if you didn't receive anything, then we have to add on 15 days.
Yeah, I think it would be about 6 years because you're actually changing the determination that you've already sent out.
Okay.
Whatever,
so we'll have another 30 days to receive comments on that. So we'll make that clear in the revised letter. So, anything else on that?
A quick question about the phases. The community center expansion, is that part of phase three?
No. That's separate.
Yeah, that's not included in any of these phases. Okay. That will be an entirely separate phase.
And of course,
phase of the Beecher project, or?
It'll be all the phase, when we've been referring to phases thus far, it's a housing phase. Yeah. So the Baxter Community Center and the park will be a totally separate phase of construction. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Yeah.
Stay.
So it's still part of the undertaking.
Yes. Okay. But it's not included in with the housing phase at this point.
So we've added some terminology. It's kind of mixed up.
No, we have stages and phases.
Yeah. So we're going to clarify how we discuss all that. Because the PA references stages and make sure we're clear on that. But I know when we talk about the residential phases, and there's demolition phases.
Right. And relocation phases.
Right. Yeah, so there's archaeology phases, relocation phases. So lots of moving parts. So, but if you have any other questions or comments, of course, you can always email them or something else. We'll get question answered for sure. So if that's nothing else on that, we'll move on. We're moving through our agenda. Still daylight. I think that is probably. On the agenda, I did have residential phase 4 and 5, and Kathleen.
Is Ashley off the line? Because I don't really think there's
Ashley's still here.
Good.
And, oh.
We just have sort of a general update. We had an LC3 meeting today in the office that was very productive. There were continuing conversations with them about the Muhammad Ali facing block. And then we are also going to be meeting with QHC next week at the conference to discuss the financing for the future phases.
So essentially they're still kind of, those two phases are still being fine-tuned depending on the discussions about the blocks on Muhammad Ali.
Right, and then just
Our consulting party's quarterly meeting schedule continues. Still those, the kind of first Thursday of the month, December, March, June, and September. So mark your calendars.
And Cynthia, also a Cuyahoga consulting party member, has been a concern that he's not been getting notified. And so I apologize to him. I didn't know if that was my fault, but we need to add him to the list. And I told him about tonight, and of course he complained about not being able to come after he
had the online.
So anyway, so but we should probably add him for the next time.
Sure. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Okay. He came once and then he said he never got any other notices.
Okay.
So
yeah.
And we will be posting notes from tonight's meeting and the presentation on the Vision Russell website, as we have in the past.
Okay, I'm telling that too.
Mm-hmm. And of course, always online. With the technology, all in to see the person. Thank you. Anything else? All right. Well, since we're convened.
Thank you.